In this episode of Zen Founder, Sherry interviews Rand Fishkin. Rand is the co-founder and former CEO of Moz. I've been a huge fan of Rand's style for many years because Rand has always been transparent about the struggles of what it takes to run a company, but I've always felt like it's a transparency that's authentic. There's a lot of transparency that comes across to me as fake or markety or just has too much kind of rah-rah BS with it. And Rand never comes across that way. He always comes across to me as someone who is just experiencing the pain of being a founder, something that I think a lot of us can really resonate with. And he talks about it in a matter-of-fact way. And he talks about mistakes that he's made and regrets that he has, but he also talks about the great things he's done and just has this level-headed perspective. So I've always had a lot of respect for him as a founder and as someone who is able and willing to kind of examine himself and his process as he goes. And this interview is really good. Sherry digs in to all kinds of topics about the struggles of being CEO and growing this company from essentially an SEO consulting firm into, you know, a widely popular SEO tool. And now it's even broader. It's more of a digital marketing tool. So I really think you're going to enjoy this one. Let's dive in.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
We know this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life. Zen founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
So, Rand, I just want to, again, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. And as I've said to you before, you are someone who has lent, I think, a very important voice to talking about the role of mental health and maybe depression in particular among founders and people in the entrepreneurial space. So I'm really glad that you have done that, period. And then I'm also glad that I get to talk to you about it too.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure, Sherry. Well, you know, it's a deep problem and it can cause a lot of destructive and negative things for founders and for their companies and for the people around them and the people who love and care about them and the people who don't. And that's something where if, you know, destigmatizing this issue through open communication can help, I want to make sure that I'm there and participating. So thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You first started talking about depression publicly, at least from what I could find, like around 2013. Is that sound right? That like your first depressive episode, or was this something that you have experienced kind of periodically throughout your life?
My suspicion is that I've experienced it periodically, but never had the self-awareness. Yeah. Until sort of my mid-30s. Right. And never had never had people around me who also talked about it. So Brad Feld, who's on Moz's board of directors and with whom my wife and I have a close friendship. And, you know, he's someone who talks publicly about that. I think that certainly helped to understand that it was okay, that you could be extremely, you know, prominent and very successful by lots of metrics and still have this issue, right? That it wasn't necessarily tied to external validation.
Yeah.
That was helpful.
Yeah. Having some people around you who can say, it's okay that this is happening. This doesn't negate everything you've done and everything you are and all that you've built. It's not a rule out.
Yeah. And having role models and people that you look up to who have transparent weaknesses as well as strengths is a very powerful and important thing. I despise this notion of casting sort of uncomplex heroes in the role of the people that we aspire to in the world. I think that creates a really unhealthy dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of it's a pervasive problem that affects not just people with mental and emotional health, but I think it, you know, it affects people of all kinds with being who they are and you know, letting them become the people that they want to be, right? We're instead sort of shuffled from childhood along these very specific lines and told, this is, you know, this is what it means to be a man. This is what it means to be a woman. This is what it means to be an American. This is what it means to be, you know, white or Jewish or, you know, whatever it is, right? And that you somehow can't vary, or if you do, you're, you know, has consequences. That sucks.
And they're caricatures. Like, they're not real. Yeah. No human is that simple. And so I agree with you. We get sort of set up to try to fulfill these very shallow and unrealistic expectations that set us all up to be disappointed in who we are. And in order to fit into those confines, we have to so narrow ourselves that we become very uninteresting.
Yeah. And I think very greatly, a lot of that is what leads to mental health and emotional health challenges, right? Because at least for me, there's many kinds, right? There's a wide range of what causes mental health and emotional issues. And I certainly don't want to pretend that I understand the full spectrum and speaking to all of them, but certainly for many of the ones that affect founders and entrepreneurs so directly, a lot of it is that your expectation of who you're supposed to be doesn't match with the reality of who you are, and that you think it's not okay to be the person you are. And that's so wrong. It's so heartbreaking. And I felt it very personally, right? And written about it. And I know that many other people have felt exactly that same way, right? They tie their professional accomplishments to their personal self-worth. And when those don't align with expectations, then, you know, they take it out on themselves. They take it out on family. They take it out on the people around them.
Yeah. And don't know how to reinvent who they want to be, who they should be.
Yeah, absolutely. And also don't, you know, aren't comfortable with the idea that it's okay to try things and not be good at them, or try things and fail, or that there's no shame in, you know, being the 9 out of 10 startups that fail as opposed to the 1 out of 10 that doesn't. That's the model, right?
Yep. Those are the stats. Was there a certain moment for you where you're like, oh my God, like I might be depressed, or when you kind of realize like, I'm not well, I'm not okay?
I think it was sort of a long journey. So I have this contrarian streak in me where even as I was realizing, hey, I'm not my ordinary self, and I'm hearing it from friends and coworkers and my executive team and my investors and that sort of thing, you know, I had this deep sort of pushback of, there's nothing wrong with me. It's just that you all cannot see the world clearly as I do.
Mm.
Right. And you know, you can't see why everything is terrible.
Right. it's not me, it's you. All of you globally, all the time.
That's right. Well, and I think one of the challenges with depression is that you, even if you logically know that you are in a dark place and a bad place, you can't sort of convince yourself to take logical positions consistently and to change your outlook, right? I don't know what it is. It's chemical, or it's emotional, or it's just this overriding feeling of, no, things are bad all the time, and I don't believe anyone who tells me otherwise. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
This special depression logic.
Yeah.
You're operating according to logic. It's just depression logic, which says like, the world is universally like terrible and out to get you. Other people are either foolish, not paying attention, or just, you know, like misinformed. You know, you have a way of logicking through that's based on this depression filter that makes everything shitty all the time.
You're totally right. Yes. It's like a switch that flips, yeah. And then, you know, new path of how
new path of logic engaged.
Yeah. And validated is followed.
Yeah. So you had people who were sort of noticing like something doesn't seem right with you, Rand, and they were giving you that feedback, it sounds like, and you were contrarian and dug in, you know, as people do, like
they do, yeah.
Everybody does. But how did it kind of shift for you where you're like, okay, no, there really is maybe something happening?
I don't think that it was the shift happened when I realized that something was wrong. I sort of, despite knowing that you're in depressive logic space, that doesn't necessarily help you get through or get over it or flip the switch back. And I think maybe a switch is a poor metaphor, right? It's almost like a very, very hard to pull lever with a, you know, with a lot of direction, right? So you don't have to be all the way at super depressed, right? You can be here And it's still really difficult just to notch it down even an inch or two. And so, you know, for me, it was not this, there wasn't a moment of realization that caused me to shift behavior, but rather a slow awakening to this, and then a realization, okay, I'm in this space, but too bad, that's mm-hmm. how the world is now. That's how I am now. That's how everything is now. And the shift out of it was an odd, random series of events. There's that Ali Brosh, I want to say her name is, the author who wrote Ali Brosh. Yeah. So she writes this comic and published a book about it. That's really excellent. And I know a ton of people who've had depression and emotional health issues of all kinds are just really identified with this, you know, sort of story that she tells of finding a kernel of corn under the fridge and having this realization that it's funny. And wait, does that mean that other things can be funny too? And does that mean there's fun in the world and not just sadness? And then somehow that sort of breaks her out of the darkest part, right? And then it's still a journey back to a healthy place. But that was exactly my experience too, right? It was, you know, I think I've written about it, right? A random episode with a marijuana edible that had recently become legal in Seattle, and then sort of a bad trip, right? An unpleasant experience around it, but then sort of a very relaxed, non-depressed weekend following that, and that leading to a journey back to a better place.
Kind of, this momentary recognition that it doesn't only feel like that. It only doesn't feel like depression. And once you get this little glimpse of a different feeling, whether it's a kernel of corn or a bad trip, you kind of remember, your body remembers another kind of emotion.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. It's weird, right? I think it's so hard to describe this because it is personal. It's different for everyone, but it's also, there are a lot of shared experiences between people I talk to who've gone through the same thing. And I think the toughest part, the saddest part, is when you catch someone in the dark part of their depression where there's none of the glimmer of hope. And it's even hard to catch someone there because they often don't talk about it. And they often don't spend time with other people when they're in it. Mm-hmm. So it's just hard.
So since deciding to talk about this publicly, I'm guessing that you've probably had lots of emails and other conversations with people in similar situations, other founders like yourself, I imagine. Did that surprise you, kind of how prolific or how common this is in the founder space?
Yeah, initially it surprised me. And then I had one experience. So we were at the Foundry CEO Summit, which I had stepped down as CEO already, but I think this was in 2014. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's probably 30-ish CEOs in the room at the end of the day. And Brad Feld, one of the partners at Foundry, is leading this discussion about, you know, mental and emotional health among founders. And he asks, you know, who here has had episodes with severe anxiety or depression? And every founder's hand, except for two, went up. So now I'm no longer surprised. I assume that it is everyone.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, not everyone talks about it. Not everyone's open about it. But I think there's a very, very strong correlation. I have no idea of the causation, but a very strong correlation between being an entrepreneur and experiencing this. And I don't know which way that runs. I don't know if it's people who are prone to anxiety and depression and mental health stuff are also the kinds of people who think I should build my own thing and mm-hmm. go this weird way.
I'm countercultural and
right. Or whether the stressors of building the company very frequently take their toll on founders as, you know, no, right? Like the odds we talk
right.
about, 9 out of 10 failure rate, the extreme. I mean, you know, once you raise venture capital, right? You're promising to return 5 to 10 times that amount of money back to the fund in a short window of time, you know, maybe 3 to 7 years.
It's ridiculous pressure.
Impossible, and yet people take that task on, right?
People sign up for that over and over and over. Yeah.
Right. And a lot of people think, if I don't do it, I'm a failure. I'm not a real entrepreneur until I take this incredibly risky, you know, probably won't make me any money, will bankrupt my mental health path. It's, I don't
Do you feel like we set founders up for depression and anxiety? I mean, is that the setup? That's like, yeah, if you're going to do this path.
For sure. Right. So I don't think you could devise a structure of, you know, sort of, you know, if you think about the economic structure and incentive model for venture investors, it's essentially, hey, we're going to put money behind, you know, a large amounts of money behind people who are mostly amateurs and haven't done this before, and sometimes, you know, second time or third time entrepreneur. And we're going to do it in spaces that are high risk and unproven. And we're going to have extraordinary expectations and in very short windows of time. And then we're going to, you know, push these folks to deliver the returns that are necessary for us, you know, to meet our obligations to our investors, our limited partners. And so I think, yeah, you set up an extraordinarily failure-prone pressure cooker, mm-hmm. and you put people inside with very little, I mean, no training, right? It's not like you go to entrepreneur boot camp and they walk you through, well, here's all the things you're going to face. You just go.
You just do it.
Figure it all out. Yeah.
And part of being an entrepreneur is having the audacity to believe that you are the exemplar, and that certainly all of that depression, anxiety stuff is not going to happen to you.
It's not going to
happen. So it's not until you're like knee deep in it that you're like, oh wait, maybe it's possible that I could be one of the 90%
yep.
that feels bad about this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the crazy part is, if you think, well, I am unique in all these attributes and I have high odds of being the 1 in 10, that does not protect you.
No.
Because I will tell you honestly, it is not, the two people who did not raise their hand were not the, you know, CEOs of the most successful companies in the portfolio. That was not how that went, right? Even the people who have, you know, to use the ridiculous venture terminology, hit the home run, mm-hmm. even those who've had more than one home run, still.
It's not a protection.
It's not. That's no shield.
What do you think might protect people? You know, people who are beginning this entrepreneurial journey or who are in the middle of it. And can we just say to them, like, sorry, kid, like, this is going to be life for you? Or is there a way that we can help support them better? Or, you know, I ask this somewhat selfishly, but also.
No, I think.
I think the setup is real.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know for sure, right? There's no sort of scientific studies where people ran founders through a program of awareness and education, or set them up with coaching, or, you know, did any of these other things and then sort of saw, oh, okay, we saw a noticeable difference. Maybe people did experience, you know, anxiety or depression or mental health issues, but it was less severe in this group than it was in the control group. There's nothing like that.
We don't have those yet. No, me either.
But that being said, I think there are worthy things to try. And some of those include talking about this openly, consistently, and addressing the fact that it is a real problem and making founders aware of it. And then presenting them with the resources to help manage that, right? So there's a pretty good correlation with people getting better when they have counseling, right? Mm-hmm. When you have actual mental health counseling and coaching, there's certainly a strong correlation, with people who get better when they are able to be transparent with the people around them in a safe environment, right? Mm-hmm. So if you can tell your board members, I'm experiencing this, and instead of them saying, I see, well, we should be looking for a new CEO, right?
Yeah.
Instead of that conversation, I think what you need is a safe space where you can have that openly and they can say, yeah, that's something that happens to a lot of founders. Mm-hmm. You should talk to some of, you know, these other founders that I've invested in who had similar things. We all experience it. It is okay, and we're behind you despite this. And it's nothing to be ashamed of, and it's not something to be scared about. And then
normalizing, right? This is part of it.
I mean, one of the parallels that I think about a lot is the way GLBTQ kids experience their, you know, their early lives around their own sexuality and difference from straight cis folks, right?
Yeah.
And I think that when there's no awareness, when there's no prominent people talking about it, when there's no one, you know, no one in the media or no one in television and movies that you can name and you feel incredibly isolated and alone. And I think at that, at those points, there are statistical evidence that there's a lot more, you know, way higher rates of teen suicide and violent incidents and you know, all sorts of terrible things that happen as a result. And that when you can be transparent in a safe space, right, and people create that psychological safety for you, mm-hmm. you get really different positive outcomes. I think that's true in this world as well as that one.
That's kind of over and over in the psychological research literature. We see social support, you know, as we call it, which is connection. It's friendship. It's people in your life as the kind of strongest protective factor against really any kind of crisis or trauma. And I think that, you know, all that you're saying really fits in line with that. Why do you think it can be hard for founders to like really be connected to other people?
I don't know that the challenge is necessarily just the connection, although there are folks who do have that. One of the truths and realities about being a founder is that it is an isolating experience. And I shouldn't say being a founder, because I think it's actually more often being a CEO specifically, mm-hmm. particularly because oftentimes you will be very close with your co-founders. And then over time, you need to make difficult calls that they may disagree with, right? And so being in the CEO role in particular is very isolating, right? Because you can lose a lot of friends and colleagues and have people not trust you. And I like to say it's a shit job.
It's a really crappy job.
It's a terrible job. There are many people who aspire to it, and I'm one of them, but that doesn't make it any less of a good job, right? It's not.
Yeah. So have your important connections then been outside of work or?
For me, both, right? Yeah. I mean, I think I intentionally or unintentionally, you know, recruited a board member in Brad who was also someone that I could talk openly about this stuff to, mm-hmm. and could be a friend and colleague. And I did that with a lot of my executive team too. There's a lot of common wisdom that holds that you generally speaking should not be, you know, friends, close friends with, you know, your work colleagues, especially people who report to you. I ignored that. I'm someone who forms close relationships with people. I love people and I, you know, I want to help them and I want to have their support and their love. And that's kind of just who I am and how I operate. But yeah, for a lot of founders, it can be, and CEOs can be a really isolating experience. So yeah, to the degree that we can tell folks, hey, you need someone in your life, hopefully several someones that you can talk to this about and be open and they will be supportive. I think we also need to, it's not just the founders and the CEOs though, but it needs to go on the investor side too. Hmm. Like, hey, investors, guess what's more important than getting the money returned to your fund? Making sure your CEOs and your founders stay alive and healthy so that they mm-hmm. can, you know, be emotionally healthy operators of their businesses. And
for the long term.
Yeah, that'll probably have better returns for you too. And so these are unhealthy ways to treat people and these are healthy ways to treat people. And yeah, maybe that conversation can also make a difference.
Yeah, it does seem like by sharing publicly, that's hopefully something that has come out of your decision to talk about your experiences is that some of those conversations can happen in different places than maybe they were happening before.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. What does your kind of mental health care plan look like now? Like, I know it's a really cheesy way to ask that, but how do you try to protect the well-being of your mind?
A lot of it starts actually for me with physical inputs. So sleep is a huge one. I no longer try and assume that I can get away with 6 or 7 hours a night of sleep and, you know, on a consistent basis and operate well. I try and average 8 hours mm-hmm. a night over the course of a week. And if that means canceling morning meetings and sleeping in and turning off the alarm and, you know, not having an alarm so that I can actually do that, that's more important than whatever the morning meeting was, right? Because you can ruin all sorts of things that way. I have a bunch of actually physical therapy type of exercise stuff mm-hmm. that I do every morning to maintain some reasonable level of fitness and health. And I have a Fitbit that I use that I'm addicted to as well.
Track your metrics, yep.
Yeah, just sort of being metrics driven, knowing that I'm taking care of myself in that way can, I think even more than the actual levels of fitness, just having the like, no, I did get enough sleep. I'm being mm-hmm. responsible. I got my exercise, like I'm doing those maintenance types of things. And then another thing, I'm not currently in it, but I suspect I will as I go, you know, build another company next year. which is to get some professional counseling, which I did for a long time. And it's not a wholly enjoyable experience, and you don't always know that what you're getting out of it, but it is really healthy to have that professional level of therapy, right?
Yeah.
I think that's something, that's another really interesting one when I think about things that are stigmatized. I remember as a kid, you know, my dad talking about therapy like it meant you were crazy. It meant you were
like going to get a lobotomy kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, just treated like, oh, that person is a mess and they'll never have a life worth living. And, you know, therapy is just this totally stigmatized thing. I mean, now I reflect on it and I'm like, come on, Dad. what a shit way to be. I just really.
Well, those are ideas that are sort of slow to change. I mean, that's something that people ask me about all the time. Cause you know, I'm a psychologist, I do therapy. And sometimes I just think the whatever importance I have in the entrepreneur or founder world is just being at a table and letting people realize like, oh, like a therapist is not a crazy person. Like a therapist is like a reasonable human being. Like she laughs at my jokes and, you know, like drinks the same coffee I drink. Like it's just a very normalizing experience, but people have all kinds of stigma about what they're going to experience and what it's going to feel like. And I can also, I think maybe relate to some of what maybe your experience was of it being a fairly process oriented experience.
Yeah.
Which can be tough for founders who are very outcome driven and you want to see like, where is the needle moving forward? Yes. And sometimes your therapist is like, well, sometimes the needle that's moving forward is the bad things that don't happen, which are not necessarily directly observable.
Yeah.
And sometimes the needle moving forward is years down the road in your own ability to understand and deal with your own emotions. But it, you know, it's not necessarily like, here's our 6-week plan.
Well, yeah.
Not usually, sometimes.
No, I think that's definitely the case. And the process itself can feel stymieing or frustrating. And as you know, as an entrepreneur, you often want it. You're like, I want to innovate on this. Nope. You just gotta power through, my friend. This is not, not a time for, you know, you to go hack your
therapy. How did you want to innovate on therapy? I just have to know. what were your impulses?
Yeah, when you're in there, you're sort of like, well, you know, maybe there's a more structured and data-driven way to sort of understand root cause, right? Mm-hmm. And like, oh, well, you know, I've done lots of retrospectives. Maybe we can look at this in a logic. It's that kind of stuff, right? Where you want to apply your experience in the professional world, and you want to see, to the point we had earlier, right? You want to see all the stats. Oh, well, show me how many founders have gotten better after they had this conversation with you versus this other. Shut up. Come on.
Or let's just be honest about the fact that this is a conversation that's never happened before.
Yes. And that you are a different person than everyone else. And that one size does not fit all.
It's the one place where it's really okay to be the special snowflake, but even then people don't love it. People don't love it.
Yeah.
What's your plan?
Yeah. So other things that I do for my health is I try, there are some sort of mental models that I've adopted around when I feel for me, it's usually great anger or great frustration that then leads into like this sadness and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so I try and have ways of addressing and processing those that are more healthy. A lot of that involves writing. And a lot of it also involves just having the courage to speak up about those things, right? To take action. I mean, I think that many of us, when we feel deep anger or deep frustration, we sort of shove it to the side in favor of trying to be productive and outcome focused rather than addressing the, hey, I'm working with my book editor on this. And, you know, she sent me this email and it made me feel incredibly frustrated and angry. Why did it do that? Here's all these reasons. But let me tell her those things instead of just being like, okay, well, I guess we'll work through it and like just, you know, try and drive to the outcome of what are we going to do about the book title or cover, or, you know, whatever it is, right? So that's been
a little bit more of that process, right? Like identify how you feel and think about what to do about it instead of the like.
Yeah, and share it with the person, right? Because very, very often we feel like we're trapped by circumstance when in fact we are trapped by secrecy, or by, not by secrecy, but by unwillingness to address a problem directly. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that builds up for a lot of us, builds up over time, and then becomes like this weight, right? And we don't unload the weight. We just keep carrying and piling on more stuff. And then that leads to the breaking point.
Yeah. So this mental model of really identifying those extreme emotions, paying attention to when you feel them, writing them down, processing them, and then kind of making a plan for them.
Yeah.
That kind of, okay.
It's funny. I had this experience last night. I was very frustrated and angry about this exchange, and, you know, was sort of thinking about it for a while and took the time to just, okay, we're going to be at peace for a little bit. We had a dinner with some friends, and I decided, you know what, I'm not going to bring it up at the dinner, even though it's sort of on my mind. I'm going to focus on other things and let my brain do this like processing work in the background. Mm-hmm. And then afterward, I'm going to sit at my keyboard and I'm going to write all the things out, right? And like, why did I feel upset? And what's bothering me about this? And then I'm going to translate that into a thoughtful, hopefully somewhat empathetic email and attack the problem directly, rather than just sort of either letting it fester or only addressing that the outcome that I want to get to, as opposed to what caused all the frustration.
Yeah. Thinking about the feeling part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Accepting that feelings are also part of the addressable equation, which is I think, especially for men, we're sort of encouraged not to pretend that they don't exist, right? Like a, you know, the logical, strong leader who's a man.
Use your brain.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Has this, which is just, I think that leads to a lot of.
Absolutely. One of the things that I've started doing is talking about feelings as data, which is like, just track the data, like examine the data, just take it in. It's not scary. It's just information about what's going on internally.
I love that.
You don't have to trip about it.
You have to like speak these people's language, like, okay, right. You've been trained to think that feelings are the not real thing. And so now we need to
figure out how to interact with them.
Yeah. This is one of the big frustrations that I have about sort of like the how many people treat feminism, right? And and like a push to break down traditional gender barriers and roles and thoughts is that I think that there's a lot of just what's considered masculine and what you're supposed to live up to that's totally unhealthy mm-hmm. for men. It would be unhealthy for
anyone.
Women, right? It's unhealthy behavior.
We get back to those like simple caricatures of here's what you should be in a 5-bullet list. It's like, no.
Well, and there's so much of popular culture and representation that sort of tells you you're supposed to be that. And then when you try and live up to those norms, you get very unhealthy outcomes. And so I was like, it's not, the patriarchy doesn't just hurt women. Like,
no, not at all.
It's terrible for men too. This is a battle we should all.
It puts everyone in a box.
Yeah. It's awful. There's no, even if you are a purely selfish, just evilly selfish person, you should still be wanting to break down this, you know, this problem for your own sake and for your gender's sake, even if you're unwilling to extend the courtesy to everyone else.
To other people. You can be totally selfish about it. That's fine.
You can be totally selfish about it and still totally invested in breaking down this problem.
Yeah. Are there parts of depression that you're grateful for?
It gives you deep empathy for other people who have been through it or are going through it. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful for that. But I'd really prefer not to do it again.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's a dark place, right? It can create very self-sabotaging tendencies. And I think that you lose appreciation for the amazing things and people and experiences in your life, no matter how big and small those might be. And that's a tragic thing. I think that a lot of the happiness and joy that you experience in your own life and that you can bring to others by helping them and making, you know, the world better comes from, is shut down by depression.
Yeah.
It's like stopped. So that I'm not very appreciative for it.
No,
but that one empathy piece is helpful.
I think that's a fair answer. I know it's a strange question.
No, it's, I like questions like that. I like I like digging in, right?
Yeah, I think it can be one of those experiences that you have in life that, yeah, deepens you and matures you and those kinds of things. But it's like, okay, I'll take the deep learning, thank you, and let's not do that again.
Yeah, I've had that conversation a lot of times at the company level where I'm like, okay, I know we've learned a lot through our mistakes. I would like to not learn anything for a while and just have some wins. Mm-hmm. You know, I
think that just go to work.
You just want to balance those things out.
So at some point you have to actually implement what you've been learning, right? You just need to practice. Well, I'm sensitive to the fact that we are having this conversation just a couple weeks after the loss of a founder in your community, a friend in your world, to suicide. And these are always hard conversations to know how to talk about people who we've lost in that way in particular. But I think they're really important sort of stories to tell and things to keep talking about because, per our other, the larger conversation here is that this is happening and it's real and it's deadly when we don't take seriously how people are doing inside. It means that we've lost some very bright, wonderful, amazing human beings because of their own struggles. I don't know that I have a question as much as I'm just wondering how you're thinking about that or how it's settled with you in the last couple of weeks since the loss of Eric.
Yeah. So for folks who don't know, this is Eric Ward, who was a pioneer in the field of SEO and had touched a lot of lives. And, I shared many conference stages with him, shared cabs with him a few times, had a few phone calls with him. Actually, we talked about mental health. A number of times over the years, especially after I wrote my piece on depression, we talked about how a lot of our, both of our mental and emotional health would be tied to our, the success or failures of our professional careers and, how that was unhealthy, but hard to avoid and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's hard. I mean, one of the things that it makes me reflect on is, I think Sherry, I feel like you have probably seen this, but like the rates around deaths of despair in the U.S., right? And there's sort of these, statistical analyses showing that, these are essentially, deaths by suicide or by drug overdose. And they've gone up quite massively in the United States over the last 10 years. And, the U.S. used to be relatively low compared to other countries, and now it's significantly higher.
Yeah.
By a long shot. And so that, that really, I think Eric's death and all the articles and stats around this just made me think about the pervasiveness of this problem and how frustrating it feels to, have a sense that 20 years ago, there was so much stigma. We weren't talking about this at all. And yet the health issue was not as pernicious. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It almost feels like we're catching a problem too late.
Yeah,
we needed to start talking about it when it wasn't as bad and get people help back then. But I'm not sure how to address that either.
Yeah,
it's like a hard fight.
And the language around it, even like death by despair, is so heavy. It feels so like such a sort of hopeless problem to try to address. I think we can't let ourselves off the hook though, in the sense that like suffering doesn't have to be the way that people live. No. And the despair certainly is not a normative experience. It's not what any of us want for our lives or for the lives of others. And yes, it increases. And in some ways we're getting better at measuring it and we're getting better at tracking it, which I think somewhat contributes to the change in data. But I think we're also living in a society that is unprecedentedly like high pressure and demanding and on 24 hours. I mean, we could sort of wax and wane philosophical for hours about the sociological causes of this increase in depression and increase in suicide, but it is happening around us and it's so hard to track and it's very hard to prevent. But I feel like that's part of why we're having this conversation is to again, keep reminding people to have your eyes open for yourself, but also for the people around you, checking in on people.
Yeah, for sure. I'm part of a few groups who've had very open conversations about those types of experiences and sort of, it is really great to see people like across email threads sharing their phone numbers and saying, if you ever need to talk, I'm here.
Yeah.
That's good. It's hopeful.
It's something.
It's something. We'll see.
You wanted to maybe mention what Eric's family is doing, or?
Yeah. So for those folks who knew Eric, or even if you didn't, his family is putting together, actually, I don't think it was put together by him. I believe Danny Sullivan, who's now at Google and sort of, you know, one of the pioneers in the industry, at youcaring.com/Eric Ward, put together a fundraiser to help Eric's family. Cause I think, I don't know the circumstances, but my suspicion based on my conversations with him is, you know, maybe this could really help.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, my wife and I made a donation, and
we can put a link in the show notes too.
People I would certainly encourage.
Yeah. Well, I am, as we began, just so grateful for you. And again, your willingness to keep talking about this and raising awareness. And I think it does move the needle, Rand, in terms of like helping other people know that it's okay to talk about, it's okay to talk to a therapist, it's okay to really take good care of yourself and take that all seriously and still be incredibly awesome at what you do and still be successful and still want things.
Yeah. Well,
it's a really important message.
Thank you. And thanks for help amplifying this message and reaching folks with it. Yeah. I hope there's some folks that we can help.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.